This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Concerts, presenting an evening with the Manhattan Transfer, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, May 16th at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee. Tickets and information for the Manhattan Transfer at ticketfly.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on our hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News...
An Oregon bill that would ban seclusion cells for special needs students has made its way to the governor's desk for signing.
A tar sands oil spill in Arkansas increases scrutiny on the role that oil companies play in the cleanup process.
Efforts to establish a coal terminal in Coos Bay, Oregon, have been put on hold. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2013. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by calling 877-500-5266. I'm Sasha.
And I'm Ren Green. An effort to establish a coal terminal in Coos Bay appears to be on hold for now. Krista Collard with the Sierra Club, one of a coalition of organizations opposing the terminal, spoke with KBOO's Don Merrill about the victory and why partners eventually pulled out of the effort.
There was a massive effort across the board. Communities all over the region have been, you know, really standing up and speaking out against these proposals, along with, you know, health officials, elected officials, business leaders, writing strongly worded letters, whatever that they need to do in order to defeat this. And so it was definitely it was community work that was done, definitely to make that happen. The project is derailed. That's what we're saying at this point, because we don't know what else Coos Bay might have, the Port of Coos Bay might have in mind, or who else they might be courting. But at this point, it looks like they don't have any backers, and so that's certainly good news for us. You know, definitely a lot of work went into that, including. Some transparency lawsuits where we had requested public records and they refused to give them to us, and we won a big lawsuit on that regard, and that's how we found out who the companies were that got courted by the port and Metro Ports specifically to partner. A lot of legwork went into this.
Now you are representing the Sierra Club.
Correct.
Okay. What other organizations partnered with this effort, besides the Sierra Club that you know about?
With the Power Pass Coal Coalition, we are made up of, I think, over 80 organizations now. So it's a lot to name. But in Coos Bay specifically, one of our biggest partners is Coos Bay Waterkeeper. They've been very active, you know, having conversations with the port, finding out what's going on, organizing people to speak out against, you know, the proposal. So they've been the most vocal, but it's honestly people across the region, organizations across the region, including Power Pass Coal, Climate Solutions, and many others that I could name.
Now, let me ask you about that. Now, in some negotiations between environmental groups and coal companies or power companies, sometimes the issue is brought up to where if there was just more negotiation, then maybe there could be some kind of an agreement that could be reached where both sides compromise. Is that to say that in this case there was no common ground and so there was no ability to reach a compromise?
Well, you know, it actually wasn't even about reaching a compromise. From the get-go, we were just asking for basic information from the Port of Coos Bay on who they were courting into the community to do business. And they blocked us every step of the way, charging over $20,000 for public records. And so it wasn't even about negotiations. And I think the most important thing to keep in mind with this particular proposal is that it follows in the footsteps of of other proposals that we've seen, like, for instance, Grace Harbor, where Rail America decided that they, you know, that exporting coal wasn't in their best interest. And the same has happened with Portland General Electric. People, you know, a company that's, you know, no stranger to the coal industry, and told Kinder Morgan that they would not lease them, they wouldn't lease them any land to do the coal export terminal. And so, and that was because they were concerned about coal dust ruining some of their equipment. And so these companies are doing their own due diligence and backing out on their own. And so, you know, it really isn't even, we haven't had really an opportunity to even negotiate with them.
So you say the project is suspended. Is that to say that at some point in the future, it's possible that it could be restarted? And if so, what can people do to keep up on what's going on with this issue?
Yes, it's my understanding that the project could be restarted. That would be a good question to ask the Port of Coos Bay, what their intentions are. I think that they should certainly realize that people are not interested in developing this, and companies are not, don't seem to be very interested in developing a coal export terminal either. And so, you know, moving forward, I think it's something that the Port of Coos Bay has, you know, pretty desperately pursued. And so it's something that we're going to have to make sure we keep on our radar. And the best thing that we can do is continue to file the public records request and make sure that, you know, we know what we need to know as public and as a community.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill talking with the Sierra Club's Krista Collard about the defeat of the Coos Bay coal terminal.
KBOO volunteers have stepped up their game to bring you this locally produced newscast every single evening, so now we are asking you to do the same. Joining us now are Don and Jimmy to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
That's right. You can support KBOO Community Radio by dialing 877-500-5266. If you do that, you'll get to ensure that you'll continue to hear those dulcet tones of my compadre, Don Merrill.
Let me tell you how much I love KBOO News. I love KBOO News so much that the people who volunteer to produce KBOO News, they work their heinies off, okay? You have Ren and Sasha, who are in the studio right now, reading the news. You have Rebecca, who was back in the studio, you know, doing the stories. You have Sequoina, who was producing. I mean, this news department is all volunteer, and we rock every day. And we have a different news staff every day because volunteers volunteer when they can. So that means every day, different people produce the news, and every day, it is a top-flight endeavor.
That's right. High quality, and we do everything we can to stretch your support for our station. And we're reaching out to you now. We're stretching our hand out and saying, it is time for you to step up to the plate and become a part of this effort by dialing 877-500-5266 or kboo.fm, where you can hit the tip jar on the webpage there and make it very easy for you.
And I want to, you know, take some time out to thank food donors who have donated food to us to help keep us powered as we go through this fund drive. Kenny and Zook's Deli at 1038 Southwest Stark Street, Tapalea at 28 Northeast 28th Avenue, and Montage at 301 Southeast Morrison Street. Thank you, all three.
That's right. Their support keeps us powered, and we're asking for your support to keep us powered. PGE only takes cash. They will take a check, but they prefer to take cash, and we need that assistance from you. It is expensive to keep that transmitter operating. To even pay the electric bill gets on up there, but we promise you, I can promise you, I know Don will join me in this, and everybody that's at the station right now, we will put those funds to good use, but we need your help. We need you to send those our way. The number again is 877-500-5266. All you've got to do is pick up the phone to make that call.
Let me tell you what it's involved in producing a news story. First, we find out that there may be something of interest. Then we try to track down the people who can tell us something about it. Then we try to get them to tell us the truth about what it's about. Then we try to edit it down into something that's not too long, but at least has enough information that you can make a decision. And then the whole station is sort of built around making that story available to you. So the news that we do is important, and if it's important to you, then donate. 877-500-5266 or kboo.fm. And now we're going back to the studio with Ren and Sasha.
Efforts are currently underway to clean up and contain an estimated 12,000 barrels of tar sands crude oil in Mayflower, Arkansas. The oil spill was caused by a rupture on Friday to an Exxon pipeline running through the state. The disaster and the cleanup efforts have shined a spotlight on how oil companies are deemed exempt from contributing to the oil spill liability trust fund. For more on this story, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with David Turnbull, the campaign director of Oil Spill International.
What is the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, and how does it work?
It's supposed to help support cleanup efforts and preparation for oil spills. It helps support the costs that are incurred when an oil spill occurs. So it has two parts to it. It has an emergency fund that's on the order of $50 million, and that fund is used at the discretion of the president to help deal with immediate emergency costs associated with oil spills. And then there's a larger general fund that's used to respond to claims from people affected by the oil spills that aren't covered by the oil company that would be responsible. And that's on the order of $2 billion in total, with up to $1 billion spent on any given event. It's funded by a 8-cent per barrel excise tax on domestically produced and imported crude oil, and also on imported refined products like gasoline. And it's supposed to really provide a response capability from the government to help deal with the costs associated with oil spills.
Exxon Oil, who owns the tar sands crude that's being transported in the pipeline that's ruptured in Arkansas, they won't be paying into this fund for this spill.
Right. So we uncovered last year, in fact, that there is a loophole in the tax that's used to fund this liability trust fund. And that loophole exempts tar sands oil from being taxed to help pay for this liability trust fund. In other words, Exxon has to pay taxes for the conventional oil that they pump through pipelines just like any other oil. When they pump tar sands oil, that's actually not. It's because the IRS issued a ruling that said that tar sands oil is different from conventional oil. So on the one hand, hear often from oil companies that tar sands oil is just like any other oil. It's perfectly safe. It's perfectly fine for us to be using. But on the other hand, here's the IRS saying that tar sands oil is actually fundamentally different from regular oil and therefore is exempt from this tax. Our view, of course, that tar sands oil is in fact more dangerous in a lot of ways than regular conventional oil.
What is the current balance of this trust fund?
Well, when we looked in 2012, the current unobligated cash that the trust fund had was about $130 million, and that's just some 7% of its stated goal of something like $2 billion. And that's because of the BP Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010 and the Michigan Kalamazoo tar sands pipeline spill that was also in 2010. Those two spills, amongst others, have really depleted the sort of unobligated cash that's available within this fund.
What can you tell me about your organization?
Oil Change International is a nonprofit organization. We focus on the fossil fuel industry because we view the production and consumption of oil, gas, and coal as not only sources of tremendous global warming, but also as sources of human rights abuses, war, national security concerns, and increased inequality in the world and in the United States in particular. And we also see the fossil fuel industry as being behind almost every barrier to a clean energy transition. They want to see the status quo in the United States and around the world continue, while we are seeing tremendous climate impacts on a daily basis, whether it's droughts, floods, superstorms, wildfires, what have you. We're seeing those happening every day, and we're trying to help create a way that we can see a transition to a cleaner future.
For folks listening to the conversation that we're having here, can you tell them where to go and who to see about getting involved?
We've got a website, Oil Change International. The website is priceofoil.org. And there you can find information on our analysis of this oil spill liability trust fund exemption, as well as more details on the Keystone XL pipeline proposal and all the reasons why it needs to be rejected.
I'm Robin Ryan, and this is KBOO News.
The state of Oregon is about to start collecting money that was paid to people who submitted fraudulent unemployment compensation claims. KBOO's Don Merrill spoke with Oregon Employment Department spokesman Craig Spivey about the measures as it makes its way through the Oregon legislature.
I was looking through an article in the Oregonian this morning about how the state unemployment office is going to start collecting for unemployment fraud overpayments through federal tax returns.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the impetus was for this?
Over the years, the Oregon Employment Department has always worked very hard to recoup any improper payments of unemployment insurance benefits. And the recent passage of this bill, which allows the Employment Department to tap into federal tax returns, is just one more tool that we have to be able to recoup money that was improperly paid to those who did not have it coming to them.
Does that mean then that for people who had received fraudulent unemployment payments in past years, I mean, that money will be clawed back from them by the state, or it only applies from the passage of the bill forward?
Any unemployment benefit overpayment that is still outstanding would have this opportunity. Everybody who has been affected by this has been contacted by the Oregon Employment Department and has been encouraged to set up some sort of a payment plan. So this will not come as a surprise to anyone who is affected by this.
Is there any kind of, I don't know what you would call it, clemency or anything for anyone who comes to you and says, yes, I was overpaid, as opposed to you having to go out and identify those people?
There are a lot of steps before. This is a very last step. There's a lot of steps that happen before any kind of garnishment or taking of taxes. The main thing that happens, certainly, is setting up some sort of a payment plan. And anybody who is willing to work with the Employment Department in paying back the money that was improperly paid, we work with them directly. And, again, this is just a last stop kind of effort for those that we have been unable to get any kind of payment from.
How much money is the state thinking that it'll be able to collect in these overpayments?
Well, we're looking at probably close to $9 to $10 million over the next several years that we'll be able to collect, and anywhere from $200,000 to $250,000 or so this year. And one of the things that has been good to see, or has been a good side benefit of this, is as soon as the bill became effective, we've had many, many people that have contacted us and have set up payment plans already to get this money paid back. So we've been able to avoid a lot of garnishments that way.
And that probably saves the state money, because that's not money it has to spend going after those people.
Absolutely, and that's always our first choice anyway, and I would have to say that certainly in most cases that's what people do, is they will set up some sort of a payment plan. This, as I said, is really kind of a last resort for folks that it's been really hard to collect from.
Now, you expect to be able to collect this $9 million through 2015, but it looks like there's a potential of up to $55 million you can collect?
Potentially, and again, that's an estimate as going out. You know, certainly we hope that we again don't have to get to that, and that we're able to get things resolved earlier. But that is the potential we have, and one of the things certainly that it really saves us in staff time because of being able to set up these automatic garnishments.
Just one other question. Now, these are state unemployment overpayments through tax fraud, through fraud. Why garnishing the federal income tax? Why not just present them with a state tax bill?
Well, it's money that, again, this is even though it is state paid by state employers, it actually comes through the federal government. So It's money that it comes from the federal government, and certainly we have been able to get this through Congress as far back as 2011, and each of the states have been able to set up. Payment plans through this, but it really saves the federal government quite a bit of money as well.
So everybody who can expect to pay back money has already been notified?
Yes.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill speaking with Oregon Employment Department spokesman Craig Spivey about a bill moving through the Oregon legislature to garnish federal income tax returns to repay the state for fraudulent unemployment payments.
You are listening to a membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our volunteers work hard every day to bring you this coverage of local, national, and international news. And now it's your turn to give back. Joining us now are Jimmy and Don to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
You know, I know where you are right now. You know, you're behind the wheel of your car. You're in your kitchen fixing dinner. You're on the track or the treadmill. You're working in the yard or in the garage or in the basement. And this is probably your downtime, you know, after work and before you have to start thinking about getting ready for tomorrow to do it all over again. But before you get too relaxed, just take a second and go to the phone and dial 877-500-5266 or whip out that nifty, shiny iPad and type in kboo.fm and donate to our tip jar. $60 minimum will get you a mug or a Boo Air t-shirt or the 2013 Portland Chinook book. I mean, anything that you can contribute to help KBOO meet its fundraising goal. And by the way, for this hour, it's $250. Anything that you can do to help us meet that goal, we'll take. Jimmy?
That's right. We will take it. And you can call that number again, 877-500-5266. And we are up to date. We are down with the internet at kboo.fm, and we're also down here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, where you can drop in and, you know, maybe join in a conversation about Democracy Now and genetically modified organisms being introduced into the food supply, or the nuances of exactly when the age of rock and roll did come to an end, when it became new age music, what genre of music we're in at this point in human history. The conversations that occur down here are varied. They're all over the place. And the reason that they are is because we like to be informed about what's going on in the world around us. And we bring that passion to you because you help us keep this radio station on the air and allow us the opportunity to delve into what we find interesting, what we find necessary information for you to know about, and to deliver that to you. And all you got to do is turn on a switch, and there it is right there for you, presented to you in a nice package, edited so that the audio is clear, and we cut to the chase because we don't have a lot of time. We generally have 30 minutes each afternoon to bring you the news, and then we augment that with shows such as Democracy Now!, Hard Knock Radio, Occupy Portland Radio, you know, kind of brings you some of the local stuff that's going on. And we're able to do that because you pick up the phone and you dial 877-500-5266 or go online at kboo.fm.
Let me tell you, now, since the fund drive began on March 21st, these are just a few of the stories that the KBOO News Department has done. Coverage of protests against the removal of sequoia trees from Pier Park.
A proposed bill that will protect the rights of Oregon citizens to record on-duty police officers.
An interview with the Oregon Center for Public Policy regarding flaws in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program.
Grant High School creating, yes, unisex bathrooms.
An interview with the ACLU of South Dakota on their lawsuit against local government officials for illegally removing Indian children from their birth families.
An out-of-state donor funneling cash into Oregon to support an anti-union right-to-work ballot measure. If that doesn't get your blood boiling and get you on the phone, I don't know what will.
Now, where are you going to hear that stuff except here at KBOO? And who else to give it to you except the people here at KBOO? The volunteers from the community, people that you know, people that you trust, people who are of you, by you, for you. Just like the Constitution, KBOO represents a little version of the Constitution, only we have a radio station. And to have a radio station, we have a responsibility. And that responsibility is to inform you in the most truthful, fair, and immediate way we can. Because that's what radio is. It's a medium of immediacy. And so if you want to help us continue to serve that goal, to serve that mission, call us at 877-500-5266 or visit our website at kboo.fm.
That's right. We are of the people, by the people, and for the people, like Don mentioned. And we are also right now talking about the checks and balances. Folks, we need the checks so that we can keep the account balances in the positive and continue to bring you this radio, this news, this music. You know, I'm just looking at the genre schedule that we have here, and I don't even know all the genres of music that we cover. Every time I look at it, I find a new one, whether it's African, country and western. I didn't mumble there. That we bring you country western, cowboy swing. Of course, everybody's familiar with Grateful Dead and Friends, electronic turntablism. We've got Persian art music. We're all over the place because we are here to serve the community. We're here to represent the community, and we want you to represent right now by dialing 877-500-5266. Go for it.
A bill that would ban so-called seclusion cells for special needs students is on its way to the governor. The Oregon Senate voted today to pass House Bill 2756, which would outlaw the use of freestanding isolation rooms intended to help distressed students calm down. Last December, an isolation booth in an elementary school was closed in Longview after complaints were raised by parents that it was being used for punishment. School officials say that the booth was used to prevent students from hurting themselves or others. Most of the time, students reportedly volunteered to use the booth to cool down. The proposed Oregon law would only ban the use of freestanding seclusion cells, which differ from seclusion rooms. For more on this story, KBOO's Bill Riley spoke with Representative Sarah Gelser, a sponsor of the legislation.
Could you explain the two bills we talked about, House Bill 2756 and 2585? Could you explain to our listeners what they're for?
Sure. House Bill 2756 is a bill that has now passed the House and the Senate, and it bans the use of seclusion cells in Oregon. These are freestanding, self-contained units that might be inside of a classroom that are used to lock a child inside. Once inside, the child can't leave until someone unlocks the door. This bill makes it illegal to use those in Oregon. House Bill 2585, which is in the Budget Committee right now, would have the Oregon Department of Education create minimum standards for other spaces that are used for seclusion. Seclusion is allowed to be used in public school to isolate a student whose behavior is endangering themselves or others for a limited period of time. Right now, unfortunately, we don't have any minimum standards for the spaces that are used for seclusion, and House Bill 2585 will fix that.
What was it that motivated the activity to have these bills in Oregon? Did something happen, or was there complaints?
I think there had been brewing complaints. We passed comprehensive legislation in 2011 that put a framework together for when seclusion and restraint could be used. I think that brought more attention to how seclusion was being used in public schools, and there were students and others that were complaining that they were being locked in really inappropriate places that were dangerous to them, not just physically, but also psychologically. And I think once you've seen these things, I don't think most people would imagine that public schools should be putting kindergartners and first graders in these tiny little cells.
And this doesn't apply to all seclusion rooms, right? There are other types of seclusion rooms that are not going to be banned.
Correct. So you can still have a classroom that is set aside for seclusion that is not banned under this bill. Unfortunately, there still are seclusion spaces in school districts that are inappropriate that are also not excluded by this bill. That will be taken care of by House Bill 2585 when it passes.
Do you have any idea how many seclusion rooms these bills will actually apply to?
I'm not sure about the number of seclusion rooms, but just to give you an example of the frequency of use, I visited one school personally that had four of these seclusion cells. It was a kindergarten through sixth grade school, and by the second week of January, they had used those cells over 100 times just in the school year alone. In the Senate committee last week, one of the mothers that offered testimony had done a public records request about the use of seclusion, and from just a handful of school districts that responded, there had been over 700 instances of seclusion over the course of this year. We don't know what the kids were secluded in, if they were in these freestanding cells or not,
But it does show us that seclusion is not infrequent in Oregon public schools.
Was there any opposition to your bills? And if so, what was the basis of that opposition?
I think there was some concern early on that seclusion would be prohibited altogether. There certainly are times when students need to be separated for their safety or that of others, and we worked very hard to make the bill clear that it does not prohibit seclusion altogether. There was also concern that it would somehow prohibit timeout rooms or places where students can choose to go if they're feeling very overwhelmed, and the bill does not prohibit that.
I've been speaking with Representative Sarah Gelser. I've been speaking with Oregon Representative Sarah Gelser about House Bill 2756 and House Bill 2585 to ban freestanding seclusion rooms. This is Bill Riley with KBOO News.
Neighborhoods in the North and Northeast Portland areas have long struggled with the disbursement of homeowners and families. The gentrification is spurred by new housing and business development that has taken place in the area over the past few decades. Portland State University students are preparing a forum this upcoming Thursday to discuss gentrification and how to keep longtime residents in their homes. For more, KBOO's Sequoia Wright spoke with Rebecca Kennedy from PSU about Thursday's forum.
I'm speaking right now with Rebecca Kennedy of six Master of Urban and Regional Planning students from Portland State University, which is hosting a forum this Thursday, April 4th, to discuss gentrification. Can you tell us a little bit about what concerns you are hearing from the continued gentrification from the families that are living in the neighborhood?
Well, we've been talking with a number of people in the colored community. The reason we're hosting this event on Thursday is to hear from a diverse, range of people from various backgrounds that live in Cully, about how they see their neighborhood changing, how they feel about that change, and sort of to get a dialogue going about how they think they might be vulnerable to displacement as new investment comes into the Cully neighborhood. The larger goal of that is to inform the economic and community development strategy that the community adopts moving forward. I would like to say that our project, we are six students.